next item of business is reports on standing committees.
February 10th, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, to whom was referred Senate File 23, NRC Agreement State Amendments, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February 10th, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, to whom is referred Senate File 28, Carbon Capture, Storage, and Sequestration Permit, respectfully reports back same to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole to continue discussion of bills on general file.
Thank you. Senator Coe.
The committee of the whole come back to order. Next bill for our consideration. Senate File 7. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 7, Landfill Remediation Priority List, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, which returns a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 7, and to explain, there is no amendment, sir, and to explain this fine bill, I ask that you call on the Senator from the Ivory Towers.
Senator from the Ivory Towers, that'd be Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I bring Senate File 7, Landfill Remediation Priority List from the Joint Minerals Committee. This is an update that is required by previous session law that the Department of Environmental Quality prepares to show the current prioritization of the landfill remediation priority list that you see on pages 2 through 6. They update this each year for us pursuant to that session law. And in this update, very little has changed. You recall this priority list is based on a risk evaluation. There were originally 113 landfills identified, of which 83 of those have been targeted for remediation. This list has changed very little from previous years. From the last one reported, there has been one site removed. That was the Hartville site, which was deemed not to be in need of remediation at this time. There have been two additions to the list. Those are on page 4, where priority 40 Bridger Valley was added, and on page 5, where priority 65 Uinta County number 2 was added. DEQ has updated us and said that this year what they have in the queue are priorities 1, 2, and 3, where they have written agreements in place to address a couple of circumstances in Campbell County, Sheridan 2. And then the Casper Bale Fill, and they also indicated that they were trying to work on priority project number 5 and number 11 as well in tandem with numbers 1 and 2 respectively to save costs. That legislation would be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'd call for the question.
Questions? Questions on Senator Von Flatern's motion that Senate File 7 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 7 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration. Don't forget two of them. Senate File 23. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 23, NRC Agreement State Amendments, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, ayes. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask they do so with a favorable...
Senator Von Flatern, you actually need to move rather than ask.
I move.
Farther to the left.
Ms. Jaron, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 23, and there is a couple of amendments. I ask that the first one be read in at this time.
The reading clerk will read in the amendments, the Standing Committee Amendment.
It would be the Committee of the Whole, sir.
We actually have a standing committee amendment, what I show here, Senator Von Fladen first, and then we have a committee of the whole amendment, which we'll take up when we're talking the bill, if that's okay.
Okay. I was going to withdraw. That's fine.
Senate File 23, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Von Fladen.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 23, and ask that you call on the same person from last time to explain this bill, and he can read in the amendments as they go.
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to have to find out what the difference between these two amendments is as we get to them. One second.
Well, we're going to deal with the Standing Committee Amendment first, and then we'll work with the Committee of the Whole Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 23, NRC Agreement State Amendments. Mr. Chairman, as you recall and this body recalls, we opted to become an agreement state with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission last session so that we could obtain primacy over certain aspects of regulating nuclear materials in the state of Wyoming. It was a narrow assumption of primacy, and it related specifically to source material and recovery or milling of the byproducts and the byproduct materials that are created basically in association with our in-situ mining in the state of Wyoming. That assumption then has been put into play, and over the last year, the Department of Environmental Quality has worked with the NRC to try and move us towards that agreement state status, which is a multi-year process. This legislation helps to take us down that path. It refines statutes in accordance with agreements and requested agreements between DEQ and the NRC. So as you look through this legislation, what we see is an expansion of the original NRC agreement state statute, which was 3511-2001, and we add 2002 through 2004 here, which provides various authorities to the department to enforce and make rules associated with the transport or use of source material from recovery or milling and the created byproduct materials. And that is something then that the state will take primacy over, so you don't have to have an NRC permit to do that. You'll have a state DEQ permit for that type of activity. In little B, it provides the authority to make rules and regulations associated with that. At the bottom in 3511-2003, it discusses the licensure rights of the director and the authorization to engage in licensure on behalf of the NRC or in lieu of the NRC. On 3, we see that the director is authorized to use those licensing conditions and negotiate those conditions based on the public safety and health interests of the state. You see that as we move the rest of the page 3. On page 4, there's additional enumeration of responsibilities of the director in implementing this agreement state status. On E, we see a discussion of the byproduct material and the issuing of the license with regard to that, and concurrent with federal law. And then on page 5 at the top is the right to suspend licenses when out of compliance if there's any imminent threat or anything else. On 5, we have conditions of those licenses, which are, again, consistent with the requirements under the NRC. On 6, we talk about terminating the licenses, terminating the byproduct licenses, and obligations of the state and federal government in that instance. As we move to page 7, we get some amendments to existing statutes. These amendments are amendments that provide definitions here in the beginning at the bottom of page 7 and under the top of page 8, which are simply amendments providing definitions that are specifically consistent with NRC definitions for these materials so that our statute reflects the definitions that the NRC uses for byproduct materials. recovery or milling, and source material as needed for our conformance to NRC statutes. As we go to page 8, it simply amends existing statute now that 3511-2001 was the original legislation that we passed last year, which provided that authorization to negotiate and work with the NRC to achieve this agreement state status. It's conforming legislation, and then it's requested language in our statutes that you see on page 9, basically redundant in a couple of places, which indicates that a relationship between the state authority and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission responsibilities in accordance with Section 274 of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 and the other U.S. Code as amended. So it lays out that rights, the divisions of responsibility. As we move to page 10, again, it's conforming amendments. And then Section 3, the repealer is actually a promulgation of rules and regulations, which is identical to the language that we've put back in earlier in the statutory change on page 2, little b. So it's a repealer that's just more of a movement of language than an actual repeal. Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, I would address Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, which I believe has already been moved. This is not significant or substantive. It is an amendment to conform with phrasing and language that is used by the NRC. You can see that the bulk of this amendment is to change by-product to byproduct one word, because that is how it is used in NRC language. So for consistency purposes, we were asked to change it to move into accordance with that. The bottom of page 1 simply includes additional language into this act so that the language is proper in its reference to statute that's incorporated in this act. And then finally, apparently, the NRC would like us to change 0.05 to 1/20 in a reduction of fractions that you may all recall from fourth grade. That is accomplished through this amendment also on page 2, lines 9 through 11. With that, I'd answer any questions, and if there aren't any, I'd call for that question.
Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. I think at this time, Senator Office, unless I'm missing something, the Committee of the Whole Amendment does address some technical corrections to the Standing Committee Amendment, if I'm not wrong.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't. We worked that out, and to the best of my understanding, and I would ask the Chairman for confirmation, it does nothing, and I would recommend withdrawing it. But I want to make sure that the Chairman weighs in on that before we do it.
Pardon? If the reading clerk would read in the Committee of the Whole Amendment, then we'll have Chairman Von Fladen address that.
Senate File 23, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without further objection, I would request that we withdraw Committee of the Whole Number 1 to Senate File 23.
Seeing no objection, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 23 has been withdrawn. Back on the bill. Are you ready for the question? The question's on Senator Von Fladen's motion that Senate File 23 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 23 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 28. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 28, Carbon Capture, Storage, and Sequestration Permit, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, and the committee did return a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Fladen, Senator Von Fladen, Chairman.
Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable consideration of Senate File 28, Carbon Capture, Storage, and Sequestration Permits. There is an amendment I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
The Standing Committee Amendment, would the reading clerk please read in the Standing Committee Amendment?
Senate File 28, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 22.
Senator Von Fladen.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Number 1 to Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 228, and I'd like to dispense with that right now, which is to go down to line 22 on page 2, right after operator, insert the director or and director. And so what that does is that the report will not only be given to the operator himself, but the director of the department. So once the gas, oil and gas supervisor makes his determination, they'll both get a report, which we thought was quite necessary, and it was a suggestion of the department. So I ask for any questions on that and call for the question.
Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 28. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That's been adopted. Back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the, once again, a primacy bill. We're trying to get primacy or the states and leave it with the Department of DEQ to make that determination when an enhanced oil recovery, an EOR, is then shifted or possibly shifted to a Class 6 well, which would be sequestration of the carbon dioxide. So that's what this bill does. Instead of going to the federal government and having them come in and determine whether or not we are that well or that field is no longer producing oil and the person or the operator is truly doing it for sequestration, which then falls under a Class 6, and a lot of other regulations would then follow that. We're trying to leave it with the Department of Environmental Quality with the assistance of the oil and gas supervisor to make that determination. But there's two parts to that. It's not only the sequestration of the CO2 that would kick it into a Class 6 well, which it would by itself, but it's also whether it's any danger of drinking water. And so if both those exist, whether the operator is asked or not, if both those exist and the oil and gas supervisor has made that determination, he'll give his recommendation to the DEQ director, who will then determine whether or not that is now a Class 6 well. If we do not follow through with this legislation, then it's left up to the EPA and the federal government to make that determination, which is something we've always tried to avoid, is to keep it within the state and understand what our geological strata looks like and whether or not we should make that determination and not the federal government. So other than that, it really goes down there to talk about if an oil and gas operator converts to geological sequestration or injects carbon CO2, carbon dioxide, for the primary purpose of long-term storage that results in an increased risk to an underground source of drinking water as compared to an EOR, or enhanced oil recovery operations. And then when determining, this is our Department of the Director of DEQ, when determining whether an oil or gas recovery operation is injecting CO2 for the primary purpose of long-term storage that results in an increased risk to an underground source of drinking water as compared, once again, to EOR, the director shall base his determination, and this is where we brought the oil and gas supervisor in this, the oil and gas supervisor has a different mission in life versus the director of DEQ, but he'll base his determination on findings that the recommendations of the supervisor of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So he'll base it on it, but they have two separate missions in life, so one may be different than the other. And then he'll make his recommendations. There's a public hearing where the operator, and you may see some other amendment, but the operator can then say, your determination's wrong, I'm still producing oil out of that field, this is not a sequestration or long-term storage, so I object. There is a public hearing in there where he can ask for a public hearing, and that has to be done within 15 days. And the director, the DEQ director, may participate in the hearings. If there is a change in the primary purpose to long-term storage and an increase in risk to the underground source of drinking water as compared to enhanced oil recovery, then they can make that determination and they can have the public hearing. And if they still agree, then he'll be kicked into the Class 6 well and be considered long-term storage and or sequestration. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for questions on the bill.
Questions on the bill?
Questions.
The question is on Senator Von Flader's motion that Senate file 28 do pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate file 28 is passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate file 44. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate file 44, obsolete statutory language, health care, an act relating to health care, sponsored by the Labor Committee, was referred to committee number 10, Labor, which returns a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the committee of the whole rise and report it. Do so with a recommendation that Senate file 44 do pass. With no standing committee amendment, I yield to Senator Driscoll for an explanation of the Senate file.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. If you pick your bill up and read the preamble on it, this is a cleanup bill, and it goes through it fairly in-depth on the read-in on it. I won't go through it because it's lengthy because of the amount of statutes that it goes into, but it's in pretty simple language at the start of the bill. A couple things it does do that goes beyond cleanup in this bill is it repeals the $2 fee for attendant certification. We had testimony on that the fees basically cost more than they're worth, results in a couple $1,000s less overall on to the budget. It also runs into a place where we do a temporary emergency licensure that has not been there in case of emergency needs for the department, which they haven't had the ability in the past to be able to do emergency licensures, what left them unable to do it. Pretty much that picks up the whole bill. It cleans language up. Another example of it is one of the members of the the board is designated by the Wyoming Obstetric Gynecological Society, which is no longer even here. So they changed it to a board-certified obstetrician. With that, I would stand for questions or ask for questions.
Discussion on Senate File 44. Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering there why we repealed the regulation of clinical laboratories and blood banks. And if the state isn't doing it, who is doing it? Because it seems like you still have to have some regulation of those type of entities.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman.
I called on Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the testimony in committee was that that language was duplicative and was in three or four different times, and that we're cleaning out the duplication.
Further discussion on Senate File 44. You ready for the question?
Question.
Questions on Senator Scott's motion, Senate File 44, passed committee of the whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 44 is passed committee of the whole. Next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 30. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 30, Initiative Review Process, an act relating to elections, sponsored by the Management Council, was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatern, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole bill or Senate File 30 and ask for your favorable consideration. Majority Floor Leader Bebout will be presenting the bill.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate. I bring this bill to you on behalf of Management Council. And many of you are familiar with the initiative and referendum process in the state of Wyoming. And quite frankly, members of the Senate, what's happened in the past is people have a policy or something that they're very concerned about and want to put in front of the voters of Wyoming, but they don't do it in our proper forum. And the way they draft that and the way they ultimately go to the people for their signatures does not conform and work within our statutes. And they go to a lot of trouble. And, in fact, I can remember years ago, Mr. Chairman, when one of these was passed by the voters of Wyoming and then the legislature had to go in and fix it, because it didn't conform to statutes and all the referrals and notwithstanding and those kind of things. And quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, what happened, the media, no surprising to a lot of us, made us look like we were trying to change the will of the people. And all we were trying to do was make it conform, and so it would be something that would be workable. And so that's what this bill does, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the bill, it goes on page 1 under Wyoming Statute 2224304. We say that if they're going to bring an initiative referendum, of course, the process is that it goes to the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State under current law can go to the LSO and say, would you review this? Well, that's pretty loosey-goosey, and quite frankly, you know, we can do as much as we want to or as little as we want to. The last initiative that was dealt with by our LSO staff was last year. Many of you are familiar with that issue, and it was we spent hundreds of hours and never did get it in a format that was really consistent or would work if it was to pass and come to the legislature to be included in our statute. So what this bill says on line 15, the proposed bill shall be in format required for bills by Wyoming Statute 8-1-105. That's what we have to do. And it only makes sense that if they're going to go to the trouble to get the signatures and they're going to write up a bill to do that and have it presented to the people of Wyoming, they ought to do it right. And so what happens is the Secretary of State requests them to do it. In fact, he should all even provide them a copy of that format so they will have an idea what we need to do. If you go on further on page 2, Mr. Chairman, you know, there's some language in there. This is consistent with our rules that if they're holding a conference and the Secretary of State, of course, would hold that conference with the proponents of the initiative, that we give them a 10-day leeway if it happens while the legislature is in session. And further on, Mr. Chairman, on page 3, we give them a 30-day extension for that same subsection or subconference that would occur under subsection B as a result of the abatement during the legislative session. The really important thing, Mr. Chairman, is to try to assist these people that spend a lot of time and energy to bring a referendum to the voters of Wyoming. And quite frankly, if with this law, the way it's said now, if in fact they cannot comply with our statute and the Secretary of State feels like they're not complying, they can deny their petition. I'll be glad to answer any questions and ask for your support.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I agree with the intent of the bill, but I'm just wondering if we're asking people who want to do an initiative or a referendum, something that perhaps only a handful of the senators on this floor could do themselves if they were going to put forth an initiative or referendum, and that's draft a bill in the format like our LSO would. Because, you know, a lot of times we just go to the LSO with a conception or an idea, and frankly, we wouldn't have the understanding about where it goes. And frankly, I don't believe that the Secretary of State's office has any particular expertise on staff. The whole expertise lies within the LSO department. And so I think this probably puts a hurdle in there that would be so high that you'd never get the initiative in a proper form, and you have such a constrained time period to get it done in the first place. It's a burden that I think would be almost impossible for someone who wanted to do an initiative to fulfill. And so maybe some discussion about the details about where maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's going to be quicker and easier this way, and we're going to get perfect product out. But it seems like the duty is on the petition folks to put that in the proper form with some assistance with the Secretary of State's office after they write something up and the Secretary of State's office says, no, it's got to be in this form. They give you a blueprint how to do it. They come back and they do it again. And if we had our LSO staff working hundreds of hours on one circumstance, I don't know how somebody, unless they have that expertise, I don't know where they would hire and get that expertise. Maybe some attorneys would be able to draft it. I think there's some lobbyists that could draft it. But give me a comfort level that we're just not putting in something without the process to where it would essentially make initiatives completely out of bounds for the process. Frankly, I necessarily don't like initiatives that well, what they do in other states, but I want to make sure if we're going to have a process that, yeah, we do get it in the form that it needs to be as we do it, but I'd like to find out whether or not this is going to be easy enough for people to do within the time constraints that they have to get it on the ballot and then get all their petition signatures on the ballot.
Senator Vebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very good points. And And the whole purpose of this, if you go to the extended time to do an initiative and it is not conforming in a conforming language, then you're going to have to come to the legislature. We're going to have to fix it. And to me, the idea is to put this in place with the help from the Secretary of State's office. Quite frankly, I think if someone's going to do an initiative as complicated as laws are today, they're going to have to get the services of an attorney. I don't think that LSO is the only people in the state of Wyoming that can draft a bill that conforms with our current statutes. I think most attorneys can do that, and I think that's well worth the people that are bringing the initiative and referendums time to go out and do that and do it properly. And I think given the nature of Wyoming and the state we have and the way we handle that, that the Secretary of State still will be able to consult with the LSO. It's just that when they start out, they're way ahead of the game than when they start out now by just writing a bunch of sentences together by people that don't understand the law or don't understand all the circumstances and problems they may create by the way they've drafted it. So I think it helps. It's not intended to be another hurdle to get over. It's just a way, if you're going to go to all the trouble of doing it, you ought to do it right in the first place. If there's a way to make it more clear that we're not trying to make it difficult for these people, just to try to help them get the right kind of language, so if it does pass, it makes sense in our statutes, I'm willing to look at that.
Further discussion? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm kind of interested in this topic myself, and as chairman of the Corporations Committee and the work the Corporations Committee has done in election law. So this bill comes from the Management Council, which I assume is because it's relating to the staff workload and efficiency of the legislature and things like that. And I can sort of see, a couple different ways that this could play out, and I'd like to learn more about it, I think, because the understanding is that our staff spend a lot of time trying to assist with this initiative, and there's some contention that delayed, Mr. Chairman, some contention that might have delayed the initiative. It took so long to get it right. And I'd like to find out more detail about that because, it's sort of a matter of degree here. You know, if our staff actually wrote the initiative for them, they're very efficient. They could probably do it in just like our bills are drafted. It wouldn't be 250 hours or what have you. But if you're trying to teach someone how to write a bill on their own, that's a different animal, you know. And I don't know what we're talking about here because you don't want to help people too far along. But anyway, I'd like to just learn a little bit more about the background on this bill, where it came from, why it went to Management Council, not to a standing committee, and how we got here today.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think I could shed some light on these questions. With respect to our experience in the referendum or the initiative effort that was undertaken this past year, we had a bill an effort that was submitted that was difficult. It was provided to our staff. The rules do not require that our staff, LSO, dedicate time to it. And this rule does not change that. What we do say, though, is if you submit to the Secretary of State, you submit it to our office, our Legislative Services office, that they will offer changes. At that time, the folks submitting the referendum have a choice. That is, do they want to accept the changes and remake revisions, or do they want to actually just move forward on the basis of what they filed? Now, if you were to go back into the environment that we had, that effort took almost eight times. Each time our staff would review it, we would provide, it wasn't minutes, it's days. The days of reviews did opinions. In fact, one of the issues, if you're familiar with that referendum and you remember the title and you look into it, one said that this is for a specific use of this product, and it was limited, but when you looked in the bill itself, it was wide open. It actually violated the Constitution in the sense that the title did not accurately describe what was in the bill. It was actually conflicting. They were free to put that initiative on their record or on that go forward. It would have been unconstitutional for the same reasons. They're bound by the same issues that we are, that you can't go outside the title. It has to be accurately described by the title and what the voters are voting on. So with respect to the issue of our staff, what we decided, your council decided, is that we're better off to lend our staff support as much as we can to get the best product on the ballot that we can. And your choices are to say, well, we'll only review it once, we'll only review it twice, and then you're done. But you may have a product that gets or voted on that we got to live with. So the issue was, is should we restrict the number of times of review? Should we restrict the amount of time that our legislative staff is committed to it? Your council decided not to do that, that we think it ought to be. It's up to them. As many times as they submit it, we'll undertake it. In this case, the 8 submittals or whatever it was all voluntary on the applicant's part. They apparently liked each of the changes. They would try it again, and they tried it again, and tried it again, and they ultimately ended up with a product, and at some point they decide to go forward with it. Now, with respect to some of the things that we do, and you can see that when we on that bottom of page 3, we make it clear that the 30-day period, if they submit it, their 30 days is extended. So while they're listening, going through the process, it's not one of those catch-22s where you lose your time after you submit it, and if the reviews come back, you need more time. Let's go to the issue with respect to the format of the bill. What all we're simply requiring is that you comply with Wyoming Statutes 81-105. It's in the statute. Any of us can read it, and it has a format. But if an applicant simply goes out and says, well, here's a law from some other state that, and we're going to format it any way we want, if that bill is passed, what do you do with it? It has to be printed in your bills. It's got to be something that can be turned over to folks so they can find it, they can research it, and they can read it. If you want to change the statute of the state of Wyoming, it's not unreasonable to say, read the Wyoming statutes, follow the rules. And I mean, if you make a mistake, that's fine. But you can always ask for help. You can ask, and that's what happened. Assistance was provided at their request, and there was no injury to them while they were waiting to allow the four responses, because the time is extended. But we still need, if the voters vote on a bill, it needs to be something that can be printed in statutes. I suppose you could just throw it at the end of the statute and say whatever. But the bill has to be something that integrates and can be published. And it's not too much to say, look, these formats, you simply ought to at least read the statute that says how to amend and what it should look like. Now, if they don't hit the mark exactly right, there's nothing in this bill that says, then it could be rejected by the Secretary of State. But once the Secretary of State accepts it, it moves on and the process moves forward. But we do have to recognize that if the measure is successful, it creates a statute. It ought to have at least they make an attempt to make it look like a Wyoming statute, as opposed to just pulling off stuff on the internet and throwing it out and saying, you figure it out. But we're going to put it on, or you go ahead to the state of Wyoming, pay for the cost of printing it, getting it out, and have people vote on it, but we're not even going to pay attention or make any effort to even make it look like a proper statute. And you don't need to be a lawyer to look at this statute. 1-8-18, any of you can do it. This is not talking about putting it in SharePoint. And what we're doing is putting them in SharePoint. We have considerable expertise in how we integrate it and do amendments. All this is saying is that you start off with a section and a statute, and you identify it. Much different than what we do here as a group. Thank you.
Further discussion? The question's on Senator Christensen's motion that Senate File 30 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 30 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next Senate file for our consideration, Senate File 47. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 47, Juvenile Sex Offender Risk Assessment, an act relating to criminal history records, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returns a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatern. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to win the committee of the whole. Rises to report it do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 47. Senate File 47, members of the Senate, is a, we'll just take a look at it, but it's a bill that talks about the criminal history records, how they're dealt with. It requires hearings to determine the risk of offense or reoffense, and then how that information is disclosed. This is a little different than where we've been in the past, but it's really about the hearings, the judgment to reoffend, and then the appropriate disclosure. When you look over at page 2, top of page 2, line 1, minor offender, the first act is they've got to be convicted or adjudicated. And then that whole paragraph B from line 5 to the bottom of the page talks about DCI providing notification of registration once that conviction or adjudication has taken place and where that notification goes. It goes to the district attorney, the county attorney, where the offender resides. The district attorney will order a hearing with the court, and the review will indicate. And they look at the risk of reoffense, public safety, and how that's going to happen. It can provide for the offender to have an in-camera hearing. And then once the court makes its finding, over on page 2, we look at the findings. The first one on the top of page 3 is on line 1, the risk to reoffend is low. And then that information is released according to criminal history information, and that typically is your law enforcement people. That's who gets criminal histories, are your law enforcement people. On line 6, if the risk of reoffense is moderate, it expands. Notification is to the residential neighbors within 750 feet of the offender's residence, organizations in the community, including schools, religious, and youth organizations, and to people authorized previously law enforcement. Down on line 14, if the risk of reoffense is high, the notification shall be provided to the public through the same procedure to the existing statutes of notification. And that's a fairly lengthy laundry list that goes on, but the key right there, notification to the public. There you're talking about addresses, pictures, posted, everything that is out there today. Now, the factors, when the court looks at that risk of reoffense, start on the bottom of page 3. It says the conditions of release that minimize risk of reoffense, including whether the offender is under supervision at the time through a Title 14, a program in Title 14, juvenile service program on probation and parole. So rather than have me read all of these to you, those conditions and what the judge looks at, these conditions continue on down through page 4, from criminal history to their habits and conduct, the ages of the victim and the suspect, so forth, and their response to treatment over on to page 5, recent behavior, recent threats, other factors including the relationship between the offender and the victim, the number and date and nature of the offenses, and anything else the court deems necessary. That's really the essence of this bill. I want to tell you, on the following pages, we talk about how it's applied, some of the definitions, the offender's central registry, so forth, and then, of course, the effective date. A little bit about this, though, and I mentioned it yesterday, the day before when we brought this in, this bill came about as a conversation, as a result of a conversation that's been going on with the Judiciary Committee for the last couple of years. This year we took it on as an interim topic, and in testimony, right in our first interim meeting, we heard about one of the treatment facilities in the state, 27 kids that fit these type of crimes, that were originally charged with these type of crimes. By the time they were adjudicated and came to the program, of those 27 kids, 26 of them had a different charge. And the idea being, when you know, this is a concern of both the treatment centers, the prosecutors, and the judiciary, that heavy notification and all the things that go along with that may not be appropriate in some circumstances. And when we look at those numbers of 26 out of 27, there was some prosecutorial and judicial discretion that different charges were ultimately filed to put the child into the system. The concerns with that, and what we had for testimony, was that there's some difficulties that pop up when the adjudicated isn't charged appropriately. It's very difficult for them in treatment to admit to what their actual criminal past was, and then to be treated accordingly. It's hard to treat somebody for a crime they've not been committed of or will not admit to after they've been adjudicated. There's also a bit of a misjustice for the victim when the actions have not been acknowledged and what took place, and the confusion of when a victim may have been or was the victim of a sexual assault and instead has been declared legally as the victim of a battery. And so this idea of how do we appropriately recognize the actor that's been adjudicated and get them into the right program, but still recognize that it may not be appropriate to have them branded for the entire public and the consequences that come with that. One of the reasons that this may take place is it may have been a young pair of siblings. Typically, what we've also heard is that the actor is following a behavior that was modeled on them. They were a victim. And quite often the time frames are very similar to when it happened to them to when they do it to someone else. And so the idea is, how do we break the cycles? How do we make a difference? And how do we keep people charged appropriately for all the reasons we talked about earlier? This bill sets the stage for that. It is not about not charging people appropriately. It is about charging people appropriately so you can address the real problems, but not have the people, the folks in both the prosecution, the judiciary, and the treatment area folks concerned that the life consequences may not be appropriate for the original act. So that's what we're getting to. Stand for any questions and encourage your positive vote on this bill.
Discussion on Senate File 47, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask a question in this area. Mr. Chairman, this is an area where you have a wide spectrum of behavior that gets kids in trouble. You can have everything from somebody who's going to be, does a serious offense, going to be a serious offender, likely to repeat. And then I think you can have, and I've seen some circumstances where you have two teenagers in relatively the same age group, and they're just, Mr. Chairman, coming into puberty. They're just the first stirrings of sexual maturity, and you have a circumstance where somebody goes too far once and gets in trouble, and you really don't have much risk of any kind of a long-term thing. Does this bill adequately discriminate there? Because with where it's just really some kids that haven't learned how to behave yet and are not going to be trouble long-term, you don't want to permanently stigmatize them and have all kinds of notifications and whatnot. Do we have adequate safeguards so that this low-risk end of the spectrum, and I do see there's some low-risk provisions here, but what are the safeguards so that you don't get those kids in permanent trouble they would otherwise not be in?
Were there questions before Senator Christensen gets up? Senator Christensen. Excuse me, Senator Perkins.
I do have a couple questions, and kind of coming down the back end of this, but, I mean, probably 2006, 2007, we used to do this same process for all sex offenders. And then what we did in trying to come into compliance with the Adam Walsh Act and Jessica's laws and some of those types of things, we went away from this, and ultimately now you're just classified based upon the charge. So you have a list of charges, and it's there's not any discretion there. You go in, and how long you're on the sex offender registry and how long all this stuff happens is all determined basically just by reference to statute. So now this is the way I understand that, and this is applied only to those who are not charged as adults but adjudicated as minors in the offense. So this wouldn't apply to a 15- or 16-year-old who is charged and tried as an adult and convicted as an adult. This is not available to them. So this is I think that's the first question. I just want to clarify that that's the case. So this is only for those individuals. This is only then apply to those individuals who are obviously under the age of majority who are adjudicated as minors. So that's the first clarification. I want to make sure that's true. The second one I want is, as I look at this, this is not going to affect the sexual the offender registry, that regardless of their adjudication, regardless of their adjudication as a low risk or medium risk of reoffense, they're still going to the sex offender registry. I want to see if that's the case. And so anyway, I think that would be helpful for me to understand. And then why, I guess the other thing is, if ultimately it seems like the longer stigma is your assignment to the sex offender registry. I mean, that seems to almost never go away. If you go out and if you've ever gone and look at that, I mean, there's lots of times you can kind of go out and you can, it's interesting, you can see some patterns develop on there. For example, you can see a lot, anyway, we won't go into that, but so they're still going to be on that. So I'm wondering in the end, what's the benefit of going through the adjudication process? Ultimately, it seems to the real hammer ends up being on the sex offender registry for at least, I think, can you be less than 10 years? I think you have to be on there at least 10 years once you're on. And for a lifetime under certain offenses. But anyway, if you could clear those up for us and help us understand that, I'd appreciate it.
Senator Christensen, clear them up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First to the tall senator from the heartland there. The question about, does this bill give us new options? And it does. This language, when you look at it closely, it talks about factors to consider. It talks about may. And it gives the court that option in that hearing between the prosecutor presenting the hearing and the court considering all these factors. It gives them the whole new range of tools to use. And one of the issues, is that those hard lines, those boxes. If you're in the box, you know, the arrow takes you to this box. And as a result, we start to see those outcomes about 26 to 27 with discretion were charged differently than, you know, you have problems. They're not being identified or treated for what they actually did. The victims aren't being recognized appropriately. So, yes, this does give us a whole new set of tools. And that's the idea behind it. Now to the somewhat more vertically challenged senator from the same neighborhood of the state. but an all-around high-class guy. To his question, yes, it is about juveniles. This is about juveniles that are adjudicated juvenile sex offenders, not juveniles that committed the crimes that brought on adult charges or that were charged as adults. As for being still on the registry, this does not remove them from the registry. They are still on the registry. This doesn't diminish any of those serious consequences. Now, the last part of it, when we talk about the registry, and part of what this bill is trying to get to is by giving the judges the opportunity to classify in that low, medium, or high, you help reduce the stigma so that when that time elapses, that 10 years, the treatment, the goal is for the treatment, the outcomes to be more successful and to have actually changed people and accomplished the goals, especially in those low and moderate classifications. And then they can apply to have that status removed. But this is all, it's all just a set of tools to try to affect a more positive outcome when so many of these really younger juveniles, they fit in a box, and by today's standard, when that changed a few years ago, it's box to box to box. And this gives some tools for juveniles with hopefully a better outcome for them to go through.
Senator Perkins?
I got one more question that occurs to me, and just for the body's information, when we went away from this and went to the Jessica's Law, we did it under the threat that we would lose some federal funding. And then when we asked how much federal funding was at stake, my recollection was all of $64,000, and ultimately I think the program that was in place was probably had the chance to have a better program, although it was rapidly becoming unmanageable because the hearings were stacking up a long time. So I guess the two questions I have are, one is, how do you deal with the equal protection issues related to charging? So you have the prosecutor in any given district has the ability to charge this crime, and he also has the discretion whether to charge as an adult or charge the individual as a juvenile if they're under the age of 18. So what was the testimony? Where's the discussion on that? Because if we've got a hanging prosecutor in one part of the state and another one who wants to work with kids and thinks they deserve a second chance, obviously you've got some equal protection issues with respect to how those individuals in very similar circumstances are receiving disparate treatment, and which we still have that now, but I'm wondering if you had that, the conversation, and what the testimony was with respect to that. And I wondered, are there Office of Juvenile Justice funds, or is there anything else like that, that when we do this or we're putting at risk? Or, I mean, I don't know if all of a sudden, because there are some significant funds that come into the Office of Juvenile Justice, and are we putting that stuff at risk?
Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First on the charging, the goal with this, thank you, Mr. Chairman, The goal, of course, was to try to even the playing field and take away that distaste of those harsh charges with those harsh consequences by having an option for a moderated release of information, and to try to achieve that so we don't have one community charging, you know, boom, 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 and then another community who says, this isn't working, and so let's do a different charge. And so the idea is try to get people back together where we can all have the same outcomes. The Prosecutors Association was involved. We had the judiciary involved. And we had treatment folks involved in this. What was the second part of your question? If I could address the chair. Mr. Chairman, what was the second part of the good senator's question?
It was about...
What was the second part of the question?
The money. It was about the money.
There you go.
Mr. Chairman, about the money... It was a fairly small number based on the lives we're dealing with. And that number in the 60,000 range came up. But one of the things that we heard in testimony, and any of the committee that would like to chime in on this may, I'd encourage you, but that we actually weren't sure this was going to impact any of those funds. But if it did, the actual funds at risk was a fairly small pool, as opposed to the challenge of the issues. When we talk about it, one facility, 26 of 27 of the kids having charges that didn't necessarily match the original crime. There was one of the things I need to tell you about this is, for an interim topic from both the prosecutor's office and the judiciary when we invited them to talk about it. This is a very touchy and a very sensitive section of the law, and we didn't have any judges stand up and say, well, I don't charge this way or I charge that way. And the prosecutors were of the same thing. It was much more of we think this is going to work and we're going in the right direction. Even for those folks, they were not inclined to discuss both the cases and why they charged the way they did. But I think the proof that what we heard, again, and we heard it today, was from one treatment center in the state. There's obviously a challenge, and nobody disagreed with it. They just preferred not to talk about it.
Further discussion. The question's on Senator Christensen's motion that Senate File 47 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 47 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration, Senate File 56. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 56, Dietitian Reimbursement, an act relating to the Medical Assistance and Services Act, was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, which returned a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 56 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I yield to Senator Boner for an explanation of the Senate file.
Senator Boner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you'll see as you look through the Senate file, it's fairly to the point. And so basically 42-4-103, Section A, just it's a list of all the services and supplies that are authorized under our Medicaid program. And so that's what this piece of legislation does. It just goes it to the end of that list and puts inserts in there the services of a licensed dietitian. So that's what it does. Remember, this is the idea of this is to help prevent some health complications, especially those who have diabetes or suffer from hypertension and those sorts of things. So that's what the bill does. It's fairly to the point, as I said. And I'd certainly stand for any questions on the bill.
Any discussion?
Question.
Questions on Senator Scott's motion, Senate File 56, pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 56, pass Committee of the Whole. Senator Burns.
Sorry.
Apologize, Senator Burns. Next Senate file for our consideration, Senate File 49. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 49, Direct Primary Care Insurance and Exemption, an act relating to insurance, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 49 do pass. There was no standing committee amendments, and I'll explain the bill. Mr. Chairman, what's happened is there's been developed a new way of practicing medicine, and frankly, this is one of the advantages of the free enterprise system, that people get creative about how things are done and come up with ways that are more effective and efficient to do things. And that's exactly what's happened here with direct primary care. Basically, what's going on is your primary care physician is getting for a monthly fee, will take care of all your primary care needs, take care of certain drug needs, certain testing needs. It's all specified in the contract what they will do. And they cut out all the paperwork associated with third-party reimbursement, and all the incentives of a pure fee-for-service system. It's enabling them to practice medicine, Mr. Chairman, much more the way they'd like to. We have a set of physicians that are practicing this way up in the up in your part of the world, Mr. Chairman, in Powell, and they came and testified when the committee met up in Lovell, and we had heard of this coming. We talked to the insurance commissioner. They talked to the insurance commissioner, and the insurance commissioner, Mr. Chairman, much to his credit, took a very, you know, how can we be helpful kind of attitude toward this, what the people were trying to do. But he did come to us and say, look, there needs to be an exemption from the insurance code because it could be construed that this was a form of insurance. It has a slight insurance component to it. But 90% of what's going on here, it's just a better way, more efficient way of billing. The heart of the bill is on page 3, item C, lines 14 and 15. This section, which is the insurance section, does not apply to direct primary care agreements as defined. That's the rest of the bill. And the definition does put some consumer protections in. It has to be a written, you can see on page 2, a written agreement between the patient and their legal representative or health care provider. Patient may terminate without penalty. Notice and the notice is specified in the agreement and it's not to exceed 60 days. Either party can do that. It's got to describe the health care services that are provided. It's got to describe the fee that's going to be required and may allow the fee to be paid by a third party. That would be typically an employer, could be a parent or something. Prohibits the provider from receiving additional compensation for health care services included in the fee. Conspicuously states it's not health insurance and it doesn't meet the requirements of federal law, read Obamacare. The testimony all along in committee has been very positive on this. The doctors are enthusiastic. We asked them had they passed the standard free market test. Was it commercially successful? Were they getting lots of customers? Did it work for them? And the answer was a resounding yes. So, Mr. Chairman, it opens the door to a better way to practice medicine. And you're not talking big charges. I asked them what would happen if one of their senators who comes from up there applied to them, and they said the fee would be $60 a month. And that seemed quite reasonable. Potentially, they said they were getting some people who were coming in where you'd say, why do you covered by something? Why do you do it this way? Well, you would save them by saving the deductible on one extra visit to the emergency room that this could eliminate. You pay for it the whole year right then and there. So it was a good deal. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. It's a good bill that allows people, the doctors that are, you know, they're in business, to do their business a little differently in a way that's much more efficient and cost-saving for all the parties involved, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on Senate File 49. Discussion? Questions on Senator Scott's motion, Senate File 49, passed Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 49 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration, Senate File 57. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 57, Freestanding Emergency Center, an act relating to public health and safety, sponsored by the Labor Committee, was referred to Committee 10, Labor, which returned from committee a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Peterson, and Scott. Noes, Senator Driscoll. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 57 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment, and I ask it be read in at this time.
Reading clerk, read the standing committee amendment.
Senate File 57, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 5.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, briefly on the bill so that we can understand the standing committee amendment, there's being showing up in other states, including some of our neighbors, things called freestanding emergency centers, which is basically an emergency department or emergency room that is not physically located within a hospital. The Department of Health felt that there were some needs to regulate these things so that, because you're potentially dealing with life-threatening issues and you want to maintain a certain amount of standards, and that, Mr. Chairman, makes some sense to me. Same reason, basically, you want to regulate, have some regulation so that not just anything can be called a hospital. You've got to have some basic protections. And that's what the bill does. That's the effect of line 8 on page 3. But there were some problems with the way the bill came to us, and that's, Mr. Chairman, what the standing committee amendment deals with. One of them is when you look at the definition of a freestanding emergency center, it means a facility operated by a Wyoming hospital. If we were to pass that definition, and remember that applies to what it takes to be regulated, we pass that definition, a Colorado hospital seeking to have a freestanding emergency center doesn't have to be, doesn't regulate, but a Wyoming one is. I think that was opposite from the intention of the sponsors of the bill, but that was the effect. So, standing committee amendment cures that. The other thing we were concerned about was the difficulty of were we trying to fence out competition here and prevent what might be sensible circumstances in some of the smaller communities surrounding, mostly on the borders of the state, where they might want to make a freestanding emergency center that was basically tied to a larger hospital that was closer, but in a neighboring state. We didn't want to interfere with that possibility. The amendment cures that, and we did seek in, we did put in an additional protection that is item D in the standing committee amendment, that any freestanding emergency center shall accept as patients all people seeking care, regardless of age, Medicare, et cetera, and if they're not owned by a hospital, shall have an adequate hospital transfer agreement in place so that there is, if they get something that is beyond that, something where they have to stabilize the patient and transfer them, that agreement's already in place and you don't get bureaucratic delays in a circumstance where time may be of the essence. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the standing committee amendment. I'd be happy to answer questions on the standing committee.
Questions on the standing committee amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing committee amendment has been adopted. Back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, there's a committee of the whole amendment, and I would ask that be read in at this
reading
time.
Clerk, read in the committee of the whole amendment.
Senate File 57, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, after line 15.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, further reflection after the committee meeting, we probably should have said that where a freestanding emergency center is not owned by a hospital, we probably should have said Wyoming hospital. If they have a Colorado hospital or something, they ought to have a proper transfer agreement if that's where they're transferring the patient. So that we just add the word Wyoming in there, that's all it does.
Questions on the Committee of the Whole Amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Committee of the Whole Amendment has been adopted. Back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the only further explanation I have on the bill is that it does seek to provide some basic protection so that if we do get one of these things, and I think given what's going on elsewhere in our neighboring states, we may well get one of these, that it does have some of the basic regulatory protections that go with licensure so that we know they're safe for the public to use. And that's what the bill does, and I would urge passage of the bill and be happy to answer any further questions on it.
Further discussion on Senate File 57?
Question.
Questions on Senator Scott's motion, Senate File 57, passed Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 57 is passed Committee of the Whole. The last Senate file for our consideration, Senate File 43. Reading clerk will read in the Senate file.
Senate File 43, Workforce Investment Act Statutory Reference Amendments, an act relating to the authority of the Department of Workforce Services, sponsored by the Labor Committee, was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, which reports back a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senator Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 43 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment, but before we move that, I'd like to have an explanation of the bill, and I yield to Senator Kraft to explain the bill.
Senator Kraft, nice to see somebody pretty standing.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Chairman. I needed that. Senate File 43 was actually brought to us by the Department of Workforce Services, and what it actually is an updating of references in our statutes that relate to the Workforce Investment Act that was passed in 1998. Now it's not called that anymore. We have to reference it now as the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. If we don't do this, and if we don't make these statutory updates, then we were told by the department that a lot of our programs are going to be out of compliance, and thus they'll be at risk for losing a great deal of federal funding. And a couple of them that were just specifically mentioned by the department are vocational rehab, which currently receives $9,248,000 in federal funding. Oh, I'm getting a picture, too. the Wagner-Pfizer, which provides, that one provides for a whole lot of career placement opportunities, and it receives $3,500,000 in federal funds, as well as a lot of the youth service programs that are designed to provide pre-employment services for individuals that are on the DD waiver. So we're really just making those statutory updates so that we can stay in compliance and call the act by its new name. That's the bill, and I would yield that to the good chairman for the explanation of the amendment.
We're taking up the standing committee amendment. Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, may we have the standing committee amendment read in at this time?
Reading clerk will read in the standing committee amendment.
Senate File 43, standing committee amendment number 1, page 2, line 1.
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, Standing Committee Amendment does three things. Takes a word out at the request of the department on page 2, line 1, which talks about a unified plan now. Apparently, there's two kinds of plans, and they don't want to be restricted to just the unified plan. That makes sense. They asked for an immediate effective date because of the problems potentially with the feds. That's what the last part of the amendment does. And then the other one was one the committee put in. And, Mr. Chairman, it's expensive and time-consuming to run a bill through this legislature just because the feds changed the name on the act you're dealing with and maybe even tweaked it a little bit. So we put in the language on all of these or subsequent similar enactments. So if the feds change the name, I have to run it again. There were some attorneys that argued with me on the subject, said, no, that's an unconstitutional delegation. Mr. Chairman, I told him quite bluntly, it's not. We've done it any number of times. And as long as you say it's a subsequent similar enactment, it just keeps us from having to run a lot of these little bills every time the Congress thinks they get something better if they change the name on it. So, Mr. Chairman, that's what the amendment does, and I urge its adoption.
Discussion on the amendment. Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment on Senate File 43. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nays. Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. Back on the bill.
Question.
Question being called for. Questions on Senator Scott's motion. The Senate File 43 passed Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 43 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've all heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
If the read clerk would please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leaves to report as follows. Senate File 20, do pass. Senate File 21, do pass. Senate File 8, do pass, amended. Senate File 14, do pass, amended. Senate File 32, re-referred to Committee Number 2. Senate File 7, do pass. Senate File 23, do pass, amended. Senate File 28, do pass, amended. Senate File 44, do pass. Senate File 30, do pass. Senate File 47, do pass. Senate File 56, do pass. Senate File 49, do pass. Senate File 57, do pass, amended. Senate File 43, do pass, amended. Senator Coe, Chairman.
Senator Coe. Would you move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report? All those in favor said aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. The next order of business is reading introduction of bills. Got some bills to introduce? No? Not even one or two? No jackets? Oh, we'll do two. Is that all you got? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Those are really good bills.
Mr. President, are you going to share the numbers of those bills with us?
Yeah, Senate File 12 needs to talk to me, and I think we've talked about it, but I'll think about it until tomorrow. And Senate File 25 needs to really talk to me.
Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, February 11th.
Any announcements? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet in about 5 minutes in room S27 to consider the following bill, Senate File 9, Railroad Quiet Zones.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, Water Resources, will meet tomorrow upon adjournment. That's February 11th in the Jonah Room, S27, for Senate File 53, Large Project Funding, and Senate File 31, Omnibus Water Bill Planning.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 11, will meet in a phone booth to burn these bills from the good senator from Crook County. And we will meet in a phone booth so that the fire is not too hot.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 11th,
in room S19, 30 minutes after noon recess, to take up Senate File 19, Public Funds Investing, and Senate File 7.
We're looking for a JAC notice if somebody's got there. Oh, Ray, you're not done? Excuse me.
I was.
Yeah, okay.
You're
second Senate file, Senate file 17, notice of mental property transfer. I'm done.
Okay, great. All right, are we recovered? Senator Ross, or...
No, Mr. Chairman, we're not. Mr. Chairman, we've got a... I know I've seen a notice somewhere. We have a joint appropriate... The Senate Appropriations, Committee of Senate Appropriations, meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30 to take up the...
Whatever bills are on the
number
list.
Number of bills, I don't know. I can't find a notice. And I don't see a notice on my desk or anywhere on the chairman's desk or.
Let's take a look at. Is it on the notice with the green sheet or?
Those are the bills you got.
There you go.
Which ones?
Well, give it to me. I'll read them.
Committee. These three.
They've been assigned to your committee. Referrals.
Which these three right here?
Senator Hastert.
Okay, here they are.
Oh, got it.
You've got it.
Recovered.
I think I've got it here, Mr. President. The majority
right.
Leader.
Senator Perkins.
Nobody seems to have these notices on our from the anyway. Your Senate, your Appropriations Committee number two is meeting at 8:30 tomorrow morning, and I'm not exactly sure where. Have you got the agreement?
L-55
to take up consideration the following bills, Senate File number 1, Youth Challenge Program, Senate File 26, Lapsing of Appropriated Funds Amendments, and Senate File 59, Appropriations, Deferred Compensation, Automatic Enrollment Amendments 2.
To clarify, the
and
first
Senate
one was...
And Senate File what?
Senate File 11 was the first one, not 1.
Okay, I'm sorry. Senate File 11 and Senate File 32. If time allows.
Perfect. You know, the thing is I remember what it's like when your head's in one bill. It's hard to pull yourself out. Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you. Just want to note that the meeting of the Corporations Committee that was previously mentioned is going to be it starts at 7 o'clock, as that was previously mentioned. But 7 o'clock in the morning. See you then.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. President, privilege of the floor.
You may.
Members of the Senate, we officially have the karaoke award that between the House and Senate that many senators here were participated in and helped us win. I know it's not quite the Vince Lombardi trophy, but it certainly is very prestigious. It was a year ago today that we won this, and we will be having later in the session, I'm sure there'll be the 2016, and hope to have the Senate's name again on the trophy.
Here, here. Any further announcements? You've all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate is stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, February 11, 2016.